They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It's 9:08, Wednesday, July 20th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Biaca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And guys, last night I went to a rock climbing gym for the first time. Next thing to check off my bucket list, playing pickleball with John and Bill and Sue.
We look forward to that. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. Joe, you're much too young to play pickleball.
Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable. I'm glad to be back with my three amigos.
Yeah, we missed you last week. We could have had a whole bit on that.
I know. Well, we're still working on that. We're still trying to get sponsored by one of the chains around here. So we'll get there. We'll get there.
We get sponsored by Cholula or Tabasco or something like that. I think that would be right up the alley for the three amigos. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. This November, Keeneland is the place to be as the home of the Breeders' Cup World Championships, followed directly by the November breeding stock sale. Entry deadline for Keeneland November is August 1st, so it's coming right up. Learn more at november.keeneland.com. Okay, so first week of Saratoga is in the books. It was a beautiful, beautiful week weather-wise, you know, fan participation-wise, handle-wise. We talked to Andy Serling yesterday about how the handle keeps going up at Saratoga no matter what. It's just a rocket ship that keeps on going. Every time you think it's topped out, it gets better and better. On the racetrack, we had a couple of nice two-year-old performances. I thought in the Sanford Most Strike was very impressive. He kind of rebroke in that race in the last eighth of a mile. It looked like there was going to be a stretch battle the whole way, and he found another gear late. The biggest race of the weekend in terms of grades was the Grade 1 Diana Stakes. In Italian, popped out to the front, set super fast fractions, and kept going. But I thought that race, honestly, was more about who didn't run well. And now Rougier has run two pretty big clunkers in a row. She was a horse that, she was a Group 1 winner last year in France, came over, switched to Chad Brown's barn. A lot of high expectations, I thought, for her this year. She started a year with a really nice win in the Bogey. And then just the last two races, she's gotten good setups and just has not answered the bell at the, a couple other, it's funny, Chad wins the race, and I'm like, there were three other Chad horses in the race where they were kind of disappointed, guys. Chad obviously runs one, two, three, four, maybe they'll name that race after him at some point. What stood out to you guys from the weekend?
Well, I mean, sometimes I think we take Chad Brown for granted. I mean, he runs 1, 2, 3, 4 in a Grade 1 stakes race. Oh, it's Phillies and Mares on the turf in New York. Of course, Chad ran 1, 2, 3, 4. Wins the race for the seventh time. And I agree with you, Joe. I gave Rougier another chance, and she certainly didn't justify my having some confidence in her. But you look at that, it was an upset, even though Chad won, because he upset his other horses. In Italian, of the four horses, was by far the longest shot on the board at 8-1. And, she ran a sensational race. I don't know necessarily where this came from, because look at these fractions, 22-2, 45-4, 109-2, and then sets a new course record of 145.06. She set the kind of pace, like you said, it should have set it up for not only Rougier, but for Bleecker Street, who also kind of was a little bit blah in there as well, finishing fourth. And nobody made up any ground on her coming in late. So, what's the over-under on how many horses Chad Brown? Because Regal Glory is better than any of these horses. What is the over-under on how many horses he has in the Philly and Mayer Breeders' Cup turf? I got to set the over-under about 6.5 at this point. So we'll see on that. And then I just want to give a shout-out to my Jersey bred Great Navigator. Yeah. Terrific second place finish in the Sanford Stakes. And wouldn't it be cool if his next race was in the Hopeful 30 years after Great Navigator won the Hopeful? But, the Jersey Breds program has been having a tough time because of all the, competitive disadvantages they have with the other states. And it's just a lot of fun to see, a Jersey Bred shine. This is a good horse, by the way.
And just to piggyback, Bill, what you were saying about Great Navigator, it's also a great story that Eddie Owens is the trainer, because he was an assistant trainer for decades. And finally, when John Massa is no longer training, Eddie, had the opportunity to start training for Hollycrest Farm. And then he's campaigning a wonderful young horse like Great Navigator. And Joe, you hit the nail on the head. The exact term that I used for Most Strike was rebroke. Bleecker Street, I think, you know, was the odds-on favorite, just kind of threw in a clunker as, you know, finishing third in that race and really didn't pick it up. So you have to wonder about some of these, you know, older mares. Are they starting to hit the end of the road at this point? Are they just not peaking right now because it's only, you know, for God's sake, it's only July and these horses should really be peaking in October, November, you know, for the big money. We'll find out how that plays out down the road. The other interesting race that I wanted to comment on was the Quick Call, because you have a horse like Big Invasion, a declaration of war out of a Curland mare, that wins coming off the pace and wins very impressively as the odds on favorite, and runs a 100 buyer number, which, you know, which is really, you know, that's stout. I mean, that's really, really good, especially this time of year. So Big Invasion, that 3-year-old that is really rounding into form, back-to-back wins now. And I'd be curious to see how that horse is going to be campaigned going forward. And probably you'll see him run against the olders in the Breeders' Cup turf sprint, I would think.
Yeah, no, he's a really nice horse. 100 buyer for a 3-year-old turf sprinter in July. Not something you generally see. You know, we saw Golden Pal run a big race last summer at Saratoga, but that's the last one I can remember who ran that kind of a figure. And, you know, he's a little bit different because he's a closer. He's a come from behind horse, whereas I think it's a little bit easier sometimes just to pop out to the front and just bury those other horses and bottom out the field. Whereas the Big Invasion, theoretically, needs a little bit of a setup. You know, he didn't get a great setup on Sunday, but he still produced that big, big stretch run. I think Joel Rosario honestly fits him perfectly in terms of his riding style. Just a couple of other things I wanted to mention before we move on. You know, we'll get to it in the Coolmore segment, I'm sure. But Justify got his first American Stakes winner with Just Cindy in the Schuylerville on opening day. Didn't get a huge figure, but, you know, she looks like a nice horse for Eddie Keneally. Tarabi looked like a pretty good horse, I thought, for Cherie DeVoe. She was the horse that ran second in the Spinaway last year and had kind of been on the bench for a little bit, came back with a second at Churchill Downs. You know, that was the first race out of the Wilson Shoe, was the Wilton Stakes, which seems to be a little bit unnecessarily confusing for the first race out of that shoe. But, it looked okay. You know, a lot of people are like kind of hesitant to bet those races because they don't know how things are going to sort themselves out heading around that first turn. But it looked good. You know, I think as long as the riders take care of each other, and we'll get to something about that in a little bit, I think it'll be fine. You know, I know there were some issues with the shoe back in the day that Bill has brought up, but you know, I thought it looked pretty good, and the race, you know, played out, I think, in a fair way. Can't forget Chub Wagon winning the Alma Gold Stakes at Laurel. Come on. I almost forgot. How could you guys let that happen? Got a 91 buyer, so she keeps racking up the W's. Other than that, it was, you know, in terms of stakes action, it was a kind of like relatively slow weekend other than the Saratoga stuff. Just looking, City Man got a 103 buyer and upsetting the Forbidden Apple. That was a pretty good field. But I think the action is going to heat up as we go along here. We got the Haskell coming up. We'll talk about that in the weekend preview. But I wanted to mention this just in kind of a weekend review sense that Kitten's Joy, unfortunately, passed away on Friday. And he was just a spectacular horse, spectacular racehorse, spectacular stallion. And I just thought it was kind of interesting. And I don't know, like something about fate and how, you know, Sarah Ramsey died like a month ago, and then Kitten's Joy, the most famous horse named after her, dies a month later. He was 21 years old. You know, he was an outstanding horse on the track. His accomplishments, you know, superseded that as a stallion, because he became one of the top turf sires in the world, and which is not easy to do as an American-based turf sire, and especially one that didn't, you know, he wasn't like, you know, blue blood. You know, he was bred okay, but he wasn't, you know, he wasn't bred to be a superstar stallion, but he became that. You know, the race I'll always remember him for, and I posted it on Twitter, was the Joe Hirsch. And in the 2004 Joe Hirsch, he faced Elders. Was it the greatest Joe Hirsch field ever? But no, but go watch that race. Watch his turn of foot. Johnny Velasquez was just sitting on him the whole way, let him go like outside the eighth pole, and he just rocketed away from those horses. That was when I was like, wow, this is a special, special animal. You know, a lot of people were saying at the time that he was the best 3-year-old turfer since Manila. You know, Manila's a little bit before my time, but I haven't seen a 3-year-old turfer as good as Kitten's Joy since then. He's the best one still, almost 20 years later. I was heartbroken when he lost in the Breeders' Cup turf to Better Talk Now. But he was just an outstanding animal, you know, on the racetrack, off the racetrack, and just want to send condolences to people at Hillandale who cared for him and loved him, because he was phenomenal. I don't know if you guys have any memories or any thoughts about him, but he was one of those horses that made an impact over decades on the racetrack, in the stallion shed. John, you seem to be a guy who, you know, you appreciate a good turf horse. No, like he must have meant something to you.
Yeah, and no question about it. You know, you have a horse like that just continually is consistent and has good, solid horses. And it's interesting because he was a stallion that, you know, that belied the commercialability of stallions. And basically what I mean is, if you saw a Kitten's Joy yearling out there, it wasn't going to wow you. You weren't going to be like, who's that horse? Because most of them were kind of average looking. They had a very unique, set of back legs that you had to understand were kind of they were like Kitten's Joy legs, basically. So if you didn't know who Kitten's Joy was, you'd immediately, you know, cross the horse off your list because of the conformation flaw. But because of that conformation, some people would say flaw. I would say strength for turf racing. It definitely added value and added an extra push for a lot of these horses that are on the turf, especially kind of a softer yielding turf course. I think that's why the Kitten's Joy really did so well here in the States. But he wasn't a commercial success. It wasn't like anybody was running out to try to go pick up as many Kitten's Joys as you could. As a matter of fact, he was an undervalued, underappreciated stallion for a number of years during his career. And we actually bought a mare in foal to him a couple of years ago because of that. We wouldn't have been able to afford a mare like that. Her name is Knight of Thunder. And because she was in foal to Kitten's Joy, we actually could afford to buy her, because a lot of people were like, I don't want to buy that horse because the resulting foal is going to be a turf horse. Well, that resulting foal actually is going to be racing for us. And the day that Kitten's Joy died, ironically enough, we put in for the name, and her name is Kitten. So we actually have a kitten, we actually have a yearling named Kitten. It's a Kitten's Joy filly that actually Joe Orsino will be training for us in, you know, hopefully next year. But Kitten's Joy, you know, was a horse that I think, you know, was underappreciated and undervalued, especially here in the States. But Joe, as you mentioned, he just threw runners and very consistent, good turf horses, and just a little bit ahead of his time. If the safety measures and the influence of turf racing that's coming about now had come about 10 years ago, I think we'd be holding Kitten's Joy in a very different light. And he would be one of the top stallions in the country and recognized as such. And I think right now he was just like you, Bill Finley, just a little bit ahead of his time.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, honestly. Ahead of his time now with the, you know, gradual shift towards turf racing in America, I think that his legacy is going to be even better after he died than it necessarily was while he was still producing horses. And especially, you know, we used to make fun of Ken Ramsey for naming all of his horses Kitten, Kitten, Kitten. That's gonna pay off in terms of preserving Kitten's Joy's legacy, because you're gonna have all these mares all across the country who are gonna be producing good turf horses by Kitten's Joy. And I think, you know, I look forward to his legacy continuing to build as turf racing becomes more and more of a hot ticket in America. And John, you put it well, ahead of his time for sure. And I don't want people to forget what a great racehorse he was too. He ran 14 times. He was first or second in 13 of those starts. He was a multi-millionaire horse. And he just could do it all. So we'll definitely miss Kitten's Joy. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Keeneland September grads have already claimed two graded stakes at the Saratoga meet, with Grade 3 Skylarville winner Just Cindy and Grade 3 Quick Call winner Big Invasion. In the latest edition of the Breeders Spotlight Series presented by Keeneland, our buddy Chris McGrath talks to Airdrie's Brett Jones about the mating that produced Zandon, the 50th anniversary of Airdrie's foundation, and the living legacy that is Airdrie founder Brennan Jones. It's called Making New Memories, Airdrie at 50. You can find it on our TDN website. John, I assume you've worked with the Airdrie consignment or stallion division. Can you just talk a little bit about how respected that family is in the business?
Oh, no question. When we first started in the business, you know, Brary Jones was the man. He was the guy. He was the governor of Kentucky. He had one of the best farms and, you know, breeding farms in the country. And he was just a really interesting guy to talk to and just listen to, because obviously he had so many good stories about politics and about horse racing and about Kentucky history. It was like must see TV whenever Brary was at the sales. And he always brought some really good horses, homebreds primarily, to the sales. And I had a chance, you know, during the July sale to talk to Brett about, you know, what's going on at Airdrie and the fact that they had two homebreds in the Kentucky Derby this year that very few of us remember. But he did have, you know, it's unusual to have one homebred in the Derby, but he actually had two this year. And you know, it's just interesting how from a family line, you know, we talk about horses' family lines and a son of this and a daughter of that and how they do. But, you know, Airdrie is passing on from one generation to the next. And it really seems like from a business model standpoint, they're doing quite, quite well. We actually bought a preservationist colt at the new sire showcase. And I actually had to look up to see who preservationist was. But it's a prototypical Airdrie kind of horse, you know, good, solid grade two, grade one placed horse, well bred and being bred to some good, you know, mares. And they brought a couple of them to the new sire showcase and they sold, you know, quite well, again, for a turf family. So I think Airdrie is in very good hands. You know, I'm really looking forward to seeing that piece, actually, because I haven't seen it yet. But I know that the Jones family is good quality people and they are they're lifers in the business. They're ones that you can look at any given big race and there's an Airdrie connection to it.
Yep. No, definitely noticed the same thing. Definitely go check out Chris's story and that Keeneland Breeder Spotlight series overall is definitely worth checking out and reading. So we'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
When the thoroughbred world descends upon Lexington this November, there is one place you need to be. The place where history comes alive with every championship victory.
He's authentic indeed!
The place where the future is built with the fall of a gavel. The place that exists to be the heart of this industry. The center of it all. Home to the November Breeding Stock Sale and the 2022 Breeders' Cup, Keeneland.
Spitestown. Munnings. Echo Town.
It's Echo Town for Joe Talamo and Echo Town raced away.
And Echo Town is drawing away in the stretch. Echo Town wins the Allen Jerkin Stakes.
A sire line so prolific, it repeats itself. Echo Town.
The TDN Writers' Room is brought to you by Coolmore. First crop sire Mendelssohn had his first U.S. winner over the weekend with Fade the Noise, who broke his maiden by six lengths at Ellis Park on Saturday for Mike Maker. Definitely a promising-looking horse. Stakes winners for Ashford sires over the weekend include Sanford winner Mo Strike, who we mentioned in the open, a son of Uncle Mo. In July alone, Uncle Mo has had four stakes winners, and he already has 10 stakes winners total for 2022 for this month. Is pretty impressive. I keep thinking that Uncle Mo can't top himself. He still manages to do it every single year. And of course, as we mentioned in the first segment, Justify Just Cindy became his first American Stakes winner, following up the Group 2 winner that he had in Ireland, who looks very nice. Justify is now tied with studmate Uncle Mo atop the leading two-year-old sires list, with both stallions having two stakes winners. And from 10 runners in 2022, he already has four winners. Great start to Justify's stallion career, as you would expect. As a Triple Crown winner, as a son of Scat Daddy, go see him and the rest of the Ashford roster. All right, so we usually have our Trainers Behaving Badly segment with the Cops theme in the background, but this time we'll crunch them together and have jockeys and trainers behaving badly in this segment. We're going to start with the drama between Paco Lopez and Nick Juarez. Bill wrote a great story last week about this. There was a race on July 1st. I don't know if we have the video or not, but it was a race on July 1st, the seventh race, at Monmouth. Paco Lopez drifted out on his horse into Nick Juarez's path, did not look over his shoulder one time to see if he had clearance. Nick Juarez's horse stumbled, amazingly did not go down. It just shows you the athleticism of these horses, that they can clip and, you know, steady and almost go down and still manage to stay on their feet. So it could have been really, really bad. And this is the thing that Paco Lopez is famous for. And then after the race, Nick Juarez went and fought him in the jockey's room. And, you know, I'll let Bill talk about it, but he gave some great quotes to Bill about how what he had been through, like the past 36 hours. He had been to Sweden and back. He was like, the airlines had lost his bag and all this stuff. And he had basically just held his baby girl for the first time. And he comes back and Paco Lopez does something that could almost kill him, and then supposedly smirked at him afterwards. So I empathize with with his anger. But Bill, what did you think talking to Nick about that for that story?
Yeah, I mean, Nick said things that I think all jockeys that ride against Paco probably think. And, you know, wasn't afraid to say him. And here's kind of the money quote. He says of Paco, he's careless and someone has no regard for his fellow rider. You know, and that's the issue here. And we've talked about this before, and unfortunately, we'll probably talk about it again. But, you know, I know, Joe, you're kind of chomping the bit to say some things here, and I'm sure John is as well. You know, the bigger story is, you know, what are the stewards at various racetracks doing to deter Paco from doing this? And since it just keeps happening over and over and over again, the answer would have to be whatever they're doing is not enough. Now, you know, they gave Paco a 5-day suspension, and they actually gave Juarez 8 days suspension for being the aggressor in the fight against Paco. And to his credit, I think Juarez said, I'm fine with that. I deserved it. He talked about the travel and how frazzled he was, didn't get a lot of sleep and all that. But he said there's no excuse for something like that. And, you know, that's a stand-up thing to say and do. So then Paco's only going to get the 5 days. But, you know, the question is, does this just keep happening where, you know, he comes back and then in December we'll be talking about the suspension that Gulfstream gave him? Their stewards down there have been harder on him than anybody else. I mean, they pounded him pretty good. Is 5 days enough from Monmouth? I mean, I think you can surely say no. And, you know, it's if you look at it in the micro, the one incident, yeah, 5 days would be what you would give to John Doe, the jockey who did something like this. But, you know, do you have to look at this as the bigger picture? Is it more than 5 days because he's a repeat offender? Clearly, the Monmouth stewards didn't do that here. Should stewards at Monmouth or any place else that he rides look at it as a bigger picture scenario? I think you can make a good case that they should.
It's a travesty is what it is, because we've spoken ad nauseum about Paco's recklessness, and mostly me. I mean, you guys have also jumped in on it also, but I know you make fun of me about how tough I am on Paco. I'm tough on him because he's reckless. He's going to get somebody killed. And or paralyzed or hurt. And I know that jockeys, you know, assume the risk when they get on horseback and they're on an 1,100-pound animal and they're going 35 miles an hour with, you know, a number of other horses all around them. That's the job. That's what they do. And they get when they win, they get paid quite well. But they are taking their lives in their hands every single time. And that's just on their own, you know, horse that they have to worry about. When you have somebody like Paco Lopez, who not only rides his own horse, but two other horses in the race also, because he's trying to, you know, pinch horses off at the rail or pin them down or make them go wide. And he's just has a history of being very reckless. And it shows in the number of suspensions that he's received, and not only a number of suspensions, but also from various jurisdictions. So it's not just a one off. It's not just that he only does this at Monmouth or he only does this in Florida. He does this all over the place. And it's now no longer a one-off, it's a pattern. And when it's a pattern of recklessness, you have to wonder, you know, what's going on through his head as far as, you know, why he's managing his racehorse and trying to put people in precarious positions. And I know he's trying to do it to be aggressive. And we all talk about you want to have an aggressive rider because, you know, you want your horse to be hit the hole first. You want your horse to be in front and control the race. There's all kinds of reasons why you want to have a more proactive you know, a pilot on your horse, but you don't want him to be reckless. You don't want him to be to the point where he's going to hurt himself, or even, you know, on a minor rationale, you don't want to win a race and then find out you get taken down because the jockey did something that was aggressive and illegal, you know, as far as the races go. So I'm again disappointed at Monmouth for not throwing the book at him, because this, Bill, as you so eloquently put it, he's a repeat offender. It's not a one-off. It's not a situation where you say, you know, the guy had a bad race or a bad day or this doesn't happen that often. It's a pattern. It's habitual. And, you know, what is it going to take in racing for somebody to say to Paco Lopez, you need a bigger timeout or you need to be gone? Is it going to be that somebody's going to get paralyzed? Somebody's going to get killed? A horse is going to get hurt and or die? You know, what is the standard at this point? Because it was pretty egregious in my mind as far as this race. And I think that the other takeaway I have from all this is that, you know, I didn't know Nick Juarez that well. He's ridden horses for us before. But what a stand-up guy. I mean, here's a guy who just had a baby and basically is saying, like, you know, that is the most important thing to me is holding my child. And that Paco, because of his recklessness, is taking that away from me. And not only taking it away from me, but then like gave me a look like, yeah, you deserve that. You know, you SOB. Like that to me, if that was me, I would have seen red and you know, who knows what would have happened. And I think Nick handled it, you know, to the best of his ability based on all the other extenuating circumstances. But I have newfound respect for Nick Juarez after all this. And I know this sounds silly because he got suspended also, but he got suspended retaliating off the racetrack, like basically off the horse, and took it into his own hands. And I understand that. It's almost like road rage. Somebody cuts you off and gets you to the point where you're going to be in a precarious position and get hurt or possibly killed. You know, after the fact, you're going to have all this adrenaline going through you, and you're going to look for some kind of retribution.
Yeah, no, I mean, and you know, Nick made that analogy as well. He said, you know, imagine if you're driving to work every day and you're driving with, you know, with the same 8-9 guys every day, just the same people, but you know, one guy doesn't give a shit. One day he's going to cut you off. One day he's not. Would you feel safe driving? And I agree. I gained a lot of respect for Nick Juarez because he didn't try to justify his actions. He said, with me, they sent the right message because I deserve my punishment. I took things into my own hands. And if I did that out on the street, there'd be repercussions with the authorities. I have to let the authorities do their job. On my end, I think they were fair. I'm ashamed of how I acted. What they do with him is out of my control. So he wasn't trying to excuse his own behavior. He was explaining it. And yeah, like I just feel like there are so many stewards and so many racing commissions in this country who were born yesterday or legislate like they were born yesterday, and that there's no context to the things that happen with these repeat offenders. And we've seen it with trainers over and over again. Peter Miller gets 7 days for his 900th, you know, violation of the rules. And Paco Lopez, for him to only get 5 days is just absurd. And, you know, I think in this case, we were all very lucky that the horse didn't go down, that Nick Juarez didn't go down. But I think that might have been the only way to get Paco a bigger punishment, is if the horse had gone down and it had been an absolute catastrophe. And, you know, it was just very relatable what Nick Juarez said, because, you know, even if you don't have kids, which I don't, just to be through the trials of the previous 36 hours and the lone saving grace was that he got to hold his first child. Then you come back to America and watch a guy with a proven history of reckless riding smirk at you after doing something that could have killed you and left that daughter fatherless. Like, I would have wanted to destroy him too. Like, you know, you're only human. And like I said, if you watch the replay, the really egregious thing is that Paco didn't look once over his shoulder, under his shoulder, not one glance to see if he was clear. And so at best, I think Paco Lopez, who couldn't be bothered to look over his shoulder, simply doesn't give a shit about the fellow rider, the safety of his fellow riders or their horses. And at worst, you know, which the smirk would indicate, he's actively intending to injure people and drop other people. And, you know, either way, even in the most generous scenario, he's got to go for more than 5 days. Like, considering his history, it's ludicrous. And to me, the suspension next time this happens, you know, and it's going to happen again because there's no deterrent for Paco, I think it should be a year. And after that, 5 years. After that, a lifetime ban. And, you know, we talk a lot about this on the show about the impunity that certain trainers feel. And I would look at what, you know, look at what Paco Lopez must think. You know, he clearly thinks he can do whatever he wants because for the most part, he's right. Like, nothing has happened to him. He had one 30-day suspension in 2019 when he broke Romero Mirage's neck, which Nick and Bill both mentioned in the story. Other than that, it's just cost of doing business, fines and suspensions, the same kind of thing we see some trainers get away with. And it's enough. Paco Lopez, he's an immensely talented rider, and I think he could legitimately be a top 10 jockey in the country if he wasn't who he is. He's had enough chances to prove that he's not a danger to the racing community. He is, and it's time for someone somewhere to do something about it that's meaningful.
And guys, just one more thing, and I forgot to mention this before, but let's say that the racing jurisdiction, the stewards only had at their in their arsenal, a 5-day suspension. That's all they could do. I don't know if that's the truth, but let's assume that that's all they could do is at most give him a 5-day suspension. The biggest weekend in racing at Monmouth is this coming weekend. You're telling me that you couldn't have said, well, we're going to start the suspension on the 19th of July, and therefore it would go through that weekend. You can't tell me that that wouldn't be a message to Paco Lopez. Sorry, Paco, you can't ride in the Molly Pitcher or the Mammoth Cup or the Haskell or the United Nations because of what you did. We're only able to give you a 5-day suspension, but we're going to make it so it's over this weekend. You can't tell me that he wouldn't be like, oh, shit, I better think about this next time. He missed a bunch of maiden $10,000 claiming races and never went to $20,000 claiming races at Mammoth, and that's nothing out of his pocket. So if you only had the arsenal of a 5-day suspension, time it better. So at least then it would send a message as opposed to, sorry, guys, you know, I'm sorry this happened, but Paco's our leading rider, so we have to protect him.
That's the whole thing. He's still going to be leading rider. You know, it's not going to make a difference to him whatsoever. Go ahead, Bill.
John, a question for you. I know you don't run much at Mammoth, but you do run at Gulfstream. Going forward, would you contemplate telling your trainers, I don't want to use this guy?
Yeah, we have. I mean, not just to Paco. I don't want to just single him out in that kind of a situation. But we have said to our trainers, we are not going to use, you know, Joe Smith as a rider anymore. And it could be something as simple as, you know, something as egregious as what's going on with Paco, but it also could be something as simple as, like, we were supposed to have a certain jockey was supposed to come in the morning and breeze one of our 2-year-olds and never showed up. You know, so, you know, Joe Orsino taught me this years ago about giving guys days. And, you know, sometimes we give jockeys days unofficially where we won't use them for violations of just a matter of common sense. But yeah, if something is as egregious as this, then we wouldn't ride somebody like Paco. We've actually used Nick a couple of times at Mammoth, and we've used Jose Ferrer at Mammoth as well, who won the Tampa Bay Derby for us, you know, a couple of years ago in Tampa. And those are just classy guys. Those are guys that are just really good, solid people, and really care about the industry and care about the way that they ride, and care about their fellow jockey colony. And it's, you know, it's such a dangerous vocation as it is, to have somebody else out there that's as reckless as somebody like Paco in this situation. And guys, Paco's not the only one. I mean, you look at the Ortiz brothers sometimes and you got to question, you know, their aggressiveness also. And some people have said, I don't think this, but some people have said, you know, that they're in cahoots together and that, you know, if somebody, one of them doesn't have a horse that can win, they try to take out, you know, another favorite. I don't know if it's that far, but there are certain, they're aggressive riders also. And you certainly have to watch your back when they're in the race. Would I not use one of them? I don't think I get to that point yet, but there may be a point in time where you have to say we can't use those guys anymore or women anymore because they're a hazard.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, Paco is the kind, I agree that there are other aggressive riders, but Paco's the kind of guy who just does this over and over and over again. And we're very lucky that he hasn't gotten someone killed. Like just in the Fountain of Youth earlier this year, he caused like a 3-horse pileup. You know, again, not looking to his outside to see if he had clearance when he's trying to move to the outside.
What about last year's Haskell? Wasn't he involved in last year's Haskell issue? Was that him?
I felt like that was a different scenario. I felt like where Flavian's horse came in, Paco went down. Yeah. Paco was the one who went down in the Haskell. But right. You know, the point is that he's always putting other riders in dangerous situations. And, you know, when he does get someone hurt, because it's going to happen, like seriously hurt, even more hurt than Romero Mirage, that's going to be on the hands of all of the people who had the power to sit him down for a long period of time and did not do it. And again, the born yesterday stewards who act like this stuff is happening in a vacuum and there's no context. It doesn't matter what happened before. You know, there was some significant punishment for a guy that we talked about last week, Juan Vasquez, who did get suspended 3 years by the Pennsylvania Racing Commission, almost 3 years, about 2.5 years. And that was a big deal. And that was actually really satisfying. And I know the New York State Gaming Commission came out and, you know, had reciprocity for the suspension. And they had some quotes that I think turned Bill up a little bit.
Yeah, they did this before with Baffert when he got his suspension from Kentucky. So the New York Gaming Commission, first of all, let's go back. Pennsylvania, yes, did the right thing. Good for them. Mm-hmm. You know, talk about, you know, not giving somebody a slap on the wrist like Paco. They didn't slap this guy on the wrist. They beat him upside his head, which is what he deserved, giving him this long, lengthy suspension for shipping an infirm horse that had laminitis and had to be put down. But I got a real bone to pick with the New York Gaming Commission. They come out a few days later and say, Juan Vasquez banned in New York. That, to me, they might as well put out a press release that said, today is Wednesday. And so they're trying to say, look at us, look how tough we are. We're banning Juan Vasquez from New York. You had to. That's the rules of racing. When someone is suspended in one state, going back to the 1804 or whatever, the rule has always been there's reciprocity in other states. Now, if they really wanted to be tough guys, and I don't see any reason why they couldn't have done this, there was this issue between the time that Juan Vasquez got the suspension from Pennsylvania and the time it took place. It was like a week or whatever. I don't really understand why, but he ran a bunch of horses in Saratoga. Why didn't the New York Gaming Commission come out the minute those entries were put into Saratoga and saying, this guy suspended right now, he cannot run in Saratoga? That would have been showing some cojones, not this pathetic press release about this. I mean, okay, guess what? We're going to do our job. Oh, congratulations. So, you know, I mean, again, I don't know how much we want to keep going down the same path with Juan Vasquez, but, you know, we need the racing commission / gaming commissions as a whole to step up and be tougher here. And this was, you know, talk about, you know, Donald Trump did get it right. There is fake news out there. Boy, this was fake news.
Like you said, it was a PR thing because I think they were embarrassed that everyone was talking about the Juan Vasquez horses who were running at Saratoga all weekend, one of which ran third in the quick call, by the way. And yeah, I think that was just them trying to launch back at that and say, well, here, we're doing our jobs. Yeah, I agree, Bill. Totally.
Yeah. But Bill, just to put icing on the cake, you're right, because we beat up Pennsylvania a lot. They did do the right thing. They absolutely did the right thing by suspending this guy for as long as they did. And could you say, yeah, it took a long time for them to finally do it? Yeah, it did. It was a little too late, but the suspension certainly sent a message, with regard to the suspension.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Lane's End. Lane's End Stallion of the Week this week is Candy Ride, a top 10 general active sire who stands for $75,000 this year. Honestly, a bargain for a horse or a stallion as prolific as him. His most recent top performers include Chewing Gum, who won the Grade 2 Joe Hernandez Stakes earlier this year, as well as Gold Fever Stakes winner Senbei and Bourbonette Oaks victorious Candy Raid. Candy Ride is one of the coolest horses I can ever remember running, and he's obviously proven himself as a superstar stallion on the racetrack as well. So go see him and the rest of the Lane's End roster. Lots of different budget options for you on that roster. You want to go with the high end, you want to go with the lower end. Lane's End has got you covered with tons of great stallions. We'll be right back after this message from Lane's End Farm.
Accelerate, a 5-time Grade 1 winner with over $6 million in earnings. In 2018 alone, he won the Santa Anita Handicap, the Gold Cup, the Pacific Classic by a record-setting 12.5 lengths, the Awesome Again, and bested a world-class field in the Breeders' Cup Classic. A grandson of legendary Lane's End stallion Smart Strike, Accelerate stands to continue his grandsire's legacy at Lane's End.
With some of the fullest fields in the country and quality racing year-round, there's never been a better time to reap the rewards of breeding and racing in Kentucky. Purse money in Kentucky is at an all-time high, as is average purse per race, outpacing California, Florida, and New York. Kentucky breds. Breed them. Raise them. Race them. We all win.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by the Kentucky Thoroughbred owners and breeders. Kentucky Breds have been racking up the Grade 1 wins all around the world. Grade 1 Belmont Derby Invitational winner Classic Causeway is a Kentucky Bred, as is Tenebrism, who recorded her second Group 1 score earlier this month, defeating the boys in the Prix Jean Pratt and Dovey. And, you know, Ellis Park has actually turned into a really great meet. It used to be kind of an afterthought during the summer. But you look at some of those purses, they got $60,000+ maiden races, a lot of really, you know, pricey allowance races. They got good stakes schedule. And, I think that they also have worked well in concert with the Kentucky Downs meet, because we're going to see a lot of those Kentucky Downs preview races at Ellis later this summer. And obviously we all look forward to that Kentucky Downs meet. Great field sizes, great purses, great takeout. It's really, there's something for everybody there. But don't sleep on Ellis this summer. I know everybody's focused on Saratoga and Del Mar is opening this weekend, but the Ellis racing product gets better and better every year. And obviously, if you got a Kentucky bred, it's even more lucrative to race at Ellis and Kentucky Downs and the rest of the year in Kentucky. Okay, so yesterday, Bill and I talked to Andy Serling, who I'm sure you all know, but if you don't, is an excellent handicapper on the New York Racing Association broadcast, on the Fox Sports broadcast, one of the best personalities in racing and a good friend of mine and Bill's. Great guy to talk to, always has an opinion on the horses, on the industry as a whole. And of course, as I introduce him, he's the unofficial mayor of Saratoga. Everybody stops him everywhere he goes, wants a picture, wants his phone number. He's the man up there in Saratoga, so check out our interview with Andy Serling. The Green Group guest of the week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we're thrilled to welcome back friend of the show, the unofficial mayor of Saratoga, excellent Naira handicapper, Andy Serling. Thanks for coming back, bud.
Thank you. I don't ever want to think about being the mayor of Saratoga. It sounds like one of the many thankless jobs, the mayordom.
I don't know. I feel like the amount of people that must come up to you, you must feel like the mayor sometimes. But
People are just so nice. You have to be careful when you're in Saratoga. You start to get the mistaken impression that people like you. And I know Bill can relate to this. We don't want to ever get fooled by that.
Well, you come back on this show just to bring it all.
Yeah, right. It's a big letdown.
we'll start with our little general question about Saratoga. It's the only track, it seems like, except maybe Kentucky Downs, where handle goes up every single year. And every year you think, well, it topped out. It can't possibly be better than this. And it is better than this. What do you think it is other than just the aura and the mystique of Saratoga?
You know, it's a good question. Dave O'Rourke used to joke with me and he'd say it must be the red on the television that gets people excited. I'll be honest, I came into this meet concerned. I think, and rightfully so, our numbers were so spectacular last year. When you're up like 13% like we were, you think, and listen, it might rain on three Saturdays going forward and that'll sink us. I mean, you have to remember that weather's always going to be a factor. The good news is it looks pretty good, I swear, this week. So keeping our fingers crossed. But I was shocked how much we were up. And, you know, I heard somebody, I was out last night at dinner and somebody was there who works at the Horseshoe, the bar across the street from the track. And she was saying that they were busier on Saturday than they've ever been on Travers Day. And it makes me think that just a lot of people, it's starting, I mean, you know, you haven't been up as much as Bill and I, but Saratoga, even when we expanded, it always sort of stayed the August place to be. And it was a little quieter as the meet started. And of course, the last week, especially when you're into September, can get quieter. I'm just wondering now if it's starting to matter less and less. This weekend was incredible. Huge crowds. The handle number's great. Listen, the racing was also terrific this week. We averaged almost 10 and a half horses a race on the inner turf. We were up, I think, about 3/4 of a horse over last year. So all the stars were aligned for everything. And let's also be honest, Del Mar's not running. And it's funny you brought up Kentucky Downs. They're going to have to deal with Del Mar for a week this year they never dealt with before. But so I think all those things obviously played a role. But the racing was great. And the love for Saratoga just keeps growing and growing. And maybe some of it is that once somebody comes to Saratoga, they never stop coming back. And over the years, it's just going to build and build and build.
Andy, and like you said, of every metric so far through the first weekend, the numbers have been fantastic. And, you know, it's just amazing. I thought the $815 million last year was a peak kind of number you're never able to exceed. You know, again, if the weather holds up, you're going to shatter that. But, you know, the good racing obviously has something to do with that. So, you know, the day in and day out cards have been very good to start with. But let's kind of look at the stakes race picture a little bit. It looks to me like between the Haskell, Jim Dandy, and Travers, it's going to be a very exciting summer for the three-year-olds. And just give us your overview of them so far. I mean, if you had to pick the Travers winner today, which of course is ridiculous, I even ask you to do that. But, you know, who is going to emerge from this group?
It's a great question because it really is a deep group. I think Jack Christopher potentially is the most talented of them, but I do have questions whether he's really a mile and a quarter. And I think in a perfect world for Chad Brown, he sort of holds on to win the Haskell by about a neck. And everybody gets together and says, that was great, but he's not being, you know, and then the Jim Dandy, you know, the Zandons and Epicenters and early voting all run well. And they can actually get together and say, much as we'd like to win the Travers, and listen, Chad will run three in the Travers. I don't, you know, we've seen how many he'll run in a race, but I think in a perfect world, he goes to the Alan Jerkins, right? Where he's a heavy favorite because he's such an intimidating presence. But once again, if he draws off in the Haskell and runs another big fig, I'm not going to be shocked if he ends up the favorite for the Travers.
It's really hard. I think that if you look at the big three there, well, really it's the big four, because Chargers' performance was so impressive in the Dwyer that you want to see it again. And unfortunately, he's probably not running the Jim Dandy. But I think to say that he's not a member of that team, because he had credentials going to the Derby and after the race he ran, and obviously a mile controlling the race the way he did, those races can be a bit exaggerated. But to ignore him and suggest that he's not a major player of the Traverse is foolish. And I do think he's a major player. But potentially Zandon early voting and Epicenter hook up in the Jim Dandy. Now, a win isn't the be-all and end-all for any of the three. The performances will matter. I do favor early voting of that group, but I'm very afraid of Epicenter. And I think one thing we'll probably see from Epicenter is much more speed. I think Steve Asmussen did a great job with him getting the rate in Louisiana Derby. And then he was very smart in the way he handled the Derby, given how much pace there was. But I think there were lingering effects going in the Preakness. I know he had a little trouble to start, but he clearly just didn't have that Epicenter type speed. I got a feeling from a trainer like Steve Asmussen, who really, above all, understands the value of speed. Think of how good Gunrunner was when he finally started going the lead. I don't think that Steve is letting early voting control in any way in that Jim Dandy. And I think you're going to see a very aggressive Epicenter. And to be honest, I'm rooting for early voting, but I think it's going to be one heck of a race. And I think it's just going to be another part of what's a great summer, because there's good three-year-old fillies and the older horses. There's some huge talents out there.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about that last week, about what a spectacular first half of the year it's been and how many great performances we've seen. That's going to make the Saratoga product even better, because you would think you're going to see 80 to 90% of those horses show up at Saratoga. It's interesting the thing you say about the Horseshoe, because every time I've been to the Horseshoe, it's impressively crowded no matter what day you go. So I can only imagine what a Saturday or Travers Day would be like. But I want to ask about the first couple of days of racing. Obviously, it's hard to draw too many conclusions from the first 4 days, but I saw David Aragona talking about how he thinks you don't necessarily want to be on the lead on the turf right now. Is there anything in terms of the track, in terms of the trainers, that you've noticed through the first week that you would suggest people look for going forward?
Well, David was talking about the inner turf, not the melon.
Right.
And that was something that I had already said in the track trends. I had sent out the first 3 days. I just sent out the fourth and reiterated that. But I think there was only one race on the inner on Sunday. But David said, I mean, David's not copying my set of track trends. He obviously sees the stuff for himself. But that's one thing he and I have been in agreement on, that for whatever reason, and the rails, I think, were out 9 feet. And I believe at least the first 3 days we've drawn, the rails will remain out 9 feet on the inner. So I think it's fair to expect something similar. It's odd, because there have been races where, you know, the paces weren't that strong. And it just seems like horses have been closing. How much of a trend it is, you don't want to get that carried away. We've probably ran 9-10 races, like you said, but it has seemed to be a bit of a trend. I've talked about it, track trends. David feels, and I get why he does, that the main track, I think last year was a very interesting track, and he was on this early, and I think ultimately he was right. I don't think it was a speed track, but I think whether it's kickback, and it must be kickback related, he's more into kickback than I am, but I have to say there's something to it. And obviously in David's case, I respect his opinion as much as anybody in the game. The kickback or something was hindering closers. So I don't think it was a speed track. I think it was a track that was harmful to horses trying to make up ground. So it ended up helping forwardly placed horses. And I think we've seen that to a certain extent this year. I'm not as absolute as David is looking at the results. We've seen some horses close. You know, I've heard some people say something about a dead rail. That makes no sense. We've seen horses wire on the rail, that Wesley Ward, second time starter, a favorite, Trouble did this weekend. So I don't, the first winner, that impressive Bruce Levine, New York Red Maiden winner on Sunday, I don't see any evidence whatsoever to suggest there's anything wrong with the rail. It's not as hard to close up the rail, especially the kickback's an issue, because it's probably the worst spot to be, but I don't think it's the rail itself that's a problem.
Andy, I asked you about the stakes races, looking at the very positives, but we also have to take a look at, it hasn't really been a factor yet in Saratoga, but it's been a big factor throughout the season, and maybe more so in Naira than anywhere else. What's that?
It will be a factor. I mean, okay. The small fields,
you know,
this weekend.
You know where I'm going with this. And I've even suggested in print, and it sounds blasphemous, but you know, is it perhaps time to take a look at races like the Suburban, which was, you know, not a good race and had a small.
It was exciting. Let's give it a little credit. It wasn't a good field. It wasn't exciting.
You know, I think the Coaching Club, we haven't seen the entries yet, but apparently that's going to be a pretty small field this weekend as well. Is there a solution to this, or am I looking to answer a problem that doesn't exist?
Oh, no. You're not looking for an answer to a problem that doesn't exist. You're 100% right that it's a problem. To suggest otherwise is to continue, as we love to do in racing, keep our heads in the sand. I mean, listen, I was talking about on Twitter, the King George over in Europe, one of the great races run in the world every year. And it's a great field, don't get me wrong, but they have six this year. It's the biggest field in 3 years. This is not just a problem in America, but it's a bigger problem in some ways in America. The shocking thing about the King George is it's 1.25 million, and that's a huge purse for England. But, in some ways, the purses shouldn't matter in these big races because the value for a broodmare, the value for stallions, you know, there's so much intrinsic value for these races that purses shouldn't be coming into a big play. You know what it is. There's too many races, whether it's too many races here. I mean, we're trying to fill the Mother Goose, right? The Mother Goose, it pains me to think of the Mother Goose being a race that goes by the wayside. Because as I know you know, Bill, because you're old like me, you've been around a long time. If you want to learn about the history of three-year-old fillies and fillies in this country, look at the names of the horses that have won the Mother Goose. It is a veritable who's who of the greatest horses that have ever raced in that division. But something has to give, and I'm not blaming any of these tracks, but there's an Iowa Oaks, there's a this Oaks, there's a that Oaks, there's races at Monmouth, you know, there's races everywhere. And I'm not pointing a finger at any of them, I get it, but it's just giving people too many options and these races are falling by the wayside. I don't know the answer. I mean, to be fair, the coaching club is going to be a matchup of Nest and Secret Oath. And theoretically, they're going to hook up with Gerrymander, who's so impressive winning the Mother Goose. So I think there's good races within them. But the field sizes are a huge problem. And I think I'm obviously not involved in these kind of discussions, thank God. Nobody wants me to be involved. And I don't want to be involved. But I think to suggest that the stakes committee and the, you know, whatever, whether it's the board, the racing office, isn't taking a serious look about how what we're doing with these stake races and getting ready to make some changes. I can't imagine they aren't. But I don't think there's anything wrong with you talking about it. I was glad you wrote that article about it. Whether I agree with every single thing you wrote or not is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. It is an absolute issue in racing, and something has to be done because there's just too many of these big races with tiny fields and good horses for small fields. And that's just not special.
Yeah.
One of them, you get one 5-horse field and four of them can win. Okay. But when every one of them is like that, it just kind of sucks.
Well, right. Yeah, and that was the kind of thing with Belmont Day. I felt like I had such mixed feelings because from a fan's perspective, it was spectacular. It was like all the horses you would want to see. But from a better standpoint, it wasn't that exciting to me. And I didn't bet that much. I just kind of watched the races on TV. And you mentioned the Graded Stakes Committee. And I think that they do have to take a long look after this year at the schedule and what can be downgraded and what can be gotten rid of. But the other thing is the trainers. The trainers are the other factor. And basically them waiting too long to run horses for, at least from my perspective, no reason. One of the reasons I think that they use is the bounce theory. And I've heard you talk about this before, is that it's become something of a dogma, I think, with trainers, that a horse runs this figure, he can't run this figure again this soon. So this is kind of a layup question for you. It's alley-oop, you can slam dunk it if you want. But do you ever talk to trainers about that? Like, I know you're friends with a lot of them. Do you ever talk to them and have debates and arguments that why do you think these horses can't run so often?
I think one of the things the three of us share is that we've got a lot of opinions on everything. And I think as we get older and the more we're around, we start to come to terms with the fact that most people don't need to hear our opinions all the time. And they don't want to hear us tell them how to do their job.
We're in the wrong business then.
Right. Well, I can go on TV and say what I want, but I'm reticent to tell trainers, you know, they're in charge of the horses. They're going to do its best. The thing that's annoying about the bounce to me is that I thought one of the things that was supposed to differentiate good horses from average horses is good horses showed up all the time, like Cigar, right? Cigar showed up every time. So it is frustrating. And there's no question it plays a role. There's no question. And the fact that there's so many options makes it even easier for them to do this. So yes, it is definitely a role. Trainers, owners, I mean, I'm not going to tell them how to run their horses, but sure, horses making less starts for whatever reasons they are, has the breed really gotten that much more fragile? I don't know. There's so much emphasis placed on winning. Is it something that really became a big phenomenon with Zenyatta, who as good as she was, had a career that was tailored towards winning her races when she could have run in Hollywood Gold Cup, Santa Anita races, probably would have won more than her fair share of them, if not all of them. So there's so much concern about losing races. Alan Jerkins never cared about losing races. I mean, he liked to win, but he liked to run. And there are trainers, Bill Mott will run all the time. You know, he isn't concerned, but there is a lot of emphasis put on winning. And I can't answer all the reasons it happens, but sure, it's all part of the, I don't want to say problem, but it's created this situation.
More it's just statement on my part than a question, but if you want to pick up on this, I think what we're going to be talking about a year and a half from now is that the fall is gone, that nobody's going to run anymore after Saratoga and Del Mar. We're going to see, you know, that's why they had to move the Jockey Club Gold Cup to Saratoga as it was. I think a race like the Woodward is just in terrible trouble because, you know, now it used to be you had to give them 5 weeks off between the Breeders' Cup and their previous start. Now it's 2 months. So I think that's the next thing that we talk about. Is that a realistic concern, Andy?
Well, I think it's everything's on the table, right? And, you know, maybe one of the answers to that with a race like the Woodward is if people aren't going to run the Jockey Club and the Woodward, then run the Woodward 2 weeks after the race and 6 or 7 weeks before the Breeders' Cup, right? I mean, I'm just sort of toying with that idea. I'm throwing it out there. I'm not saying it's something to do. Yeah, I think that we have to look very, very hard at the race we run in the fall. I mean, you know, here's the thing. I love seeing good horses run. But I also am really into allowance races, some good claiming races, maiden races. So I don't get all that caught up in this. It's an important discussion in the game. But for me, there's so many other races besides stake races that if I don't find a betting opportunity in a stake race, I'm all right. You know, I'm fine passing races. I'm going to give my opinions. I like seeing good horses run. So I can focus on the other races. But I think, Bill, I think you're being more specific about a general. I don't think it's just the fall. I think there is truth in what you're saying about the fall, but I think that there's have to be some wholesale changes made in stakes programs in general. And unfortunately, there's just no cooperation at all, right? I mean, Churchill added all these new stakes this year. They just do whatever they want to do, and that's their business. I'm not talking about how to run their business, but they do that, and there's no cooperation with racetracks. So it certainly doesn't seem like we're coming together and going to solve the problem of stake races by all joining hands and singing Kumbaya. So, yeah, serious changes have to be made, I think, and I think you always agree.
Let's get into some positive news, because last Friday, Penny Breakage started in Kentucky, which I think is a big deal that not a lot of people talk about. I feel like you're probably more clued in to the New York State gaming process and all that. How close do you think we are to getting that in other states, especially New York?
Ask Dave O'Rourke. I really don't know. You know, yeah. I mean, I get it, and I think it's obviously a good thing. I remember when Pat Cummings got that position with the Herbert Edwards Foundation, the first thing I said to him was, you want to be a hero, work on breakage, because it felt like something maybe he could accomplish it. And, you know, the problem in his position is, and I like Pat and respect Pat, but racetracks have no impetus to listen to him. Why would we? Why? He's not really in a position to tell people how to run their business. Doesn't mean he has good ideas or not. So I like seeing the breakage thing happen, whether or not it's happening in New York or changing. I have no idea. I mean, I think it's very beneficial to fans in that regard, because it's also theoretically should be beneficial to us, because just returning more money to people's pockets, it's going to create more churn. So I see it as a positive thing, but I'm also a horse player. I can't really comment on what's going on, if anything, with NYRA and the Gaming Commission on that, because it's just, you know, I used to think saying something was above my pay grade was a bad thing. I love saying things are above my pay grade now.
Anyone take you back to the race in Saratoga? Quick look at your Twitter feed over the last couple of days. You made a point that you think perhaps, you can make some money if you can be on the anti-Irad Ortiz bandwagon. Find examples where he's overbet and try to beat him. You want to elaborate on that?
Sure. You have to try at all times to find any angle you can. And listen, picking winners is great, but we're only going to make money if we manage to find a way to find some value somewhere. And it's very hard because of the takeout, obviously. But Irad Ortiz is clearly getting dramatically overbet. He's got horses that should be 3-1 that seem to be 9-5 and 2-1. You're going to see somewhat with the Chad Brown factor as well, obviously. But it's really happening a lot with Irad. And it's more noticeable than Chad. Chad Brown's having an amazing year. His horses are, he's running positive ROIs, so I don't know if he's really been overbet. It's incredible. I don't know. We'll see if he can keep it up, but it's been amazing. But Irad is a great rider. There's no doubt about it. But so are about 8 other guys in the room, and I don't really know what advantage Irad has over his brother, over Flavian Pratt, over Luis Saez, over, you know, just one guy, Joel Rosario. I don't want to leave guys out. Manny Franco's riding very well. This is a room where very, very good riders are having trouble getting mounts. And so I look at this, I look at the paper and I think it's very rare you look and go, ugh, I can't believe this guy's riding the horse. Because most of the time, good riders are riding them. So there's just no real advantage to having IRAD, and they're betting it like it's Ramon Dominguez in the winter sometimes, mm-hmm. when Ramon Dominguez did have an advantage. A, he was a better rider than everybody else, and he was getting choice mounts. I don't think it's the case. And I'll tell you something about IRAD. You have to ask yourself the effect of Flavien Prat on these riders. And I could be wrong, but my guess is that Flavien rates to take more wins away from IRAD than any other rider because he's going to ride for Chad Brown. He seems to be riding for Todd Pletcher. And whether or not he's even the first rider of these guys, I could see him taking away. I mean, he's probably going to win a minimum of 30-something races, right? Don't you think that 8 to 12 of them rate to come from IRAD and much less from other guys? So I think it's going to be very hard for IRAD to repeat as the leading rider, not because he's not a great rider. He is a great rider, but because his business will be more affected by the presence of Flavien Prat than I think anybody else. Now, I may be proven wrong on that, and IRAD's so good it may not matter, but I would be betting against him to win the title. And yeah, if his horses keep getting overbet, I'm going to look for opportunities. I almost am never picking him right now because I just feel like you're never getting anything close to value.
Yeah, the Ramon Dominguez comparison is a good one. That's the last guy I can remember in New York that really would get bet just because of his name in the form. And Flavien Prat, it's a great point. I still take credit for him going to New York, by the way. We had him on the show, but I'm not supporting him. I said, you got to come to New York if you want to win an Eclipse Award. And then a month later, he came. He's a great rider. I'll get you out of here on this. You know, there's some new accommodations at Saratoga. It's always like a tricky dance because you want to preserve the historic nature of the track, but you also want to have new stuff that gets people excited. The paddock bar, the paddock suite, rather, that looks over the walking path to the track, I thought looked really cool. I'm not one of the elites. I probably can't get in there, but I think Andy can talk his way into there. Have you checked out any of the new accommodations? Like, what's some new stuff at the track that you like?
I think the paddock bar thing is great. And it was so ridiculous that all these people on Twitter, they've never seen it, never been there, were criticizing it beforehand because it made a permanent structure out of that very popular paddock bar instead of some tent that looked kind of random. And now there's an upstairs thing that's taken nothing away. It's just added a new convenience. And I haven't been up there. I imagine I might end up there at some point. I don't know. I'm not eager to run over there, but I might end up there. I think it's great. And I think one of the good things, and I'm going to tell you something, these are Dave O'Rourke things. Dave has a problem with taking credit for things. I'm going to give him credit. Dave is a major, major part of that paddock bar in all ways. Dave is the one who created the top of the stretch area, the more informal box area, because Dave saw, and this was before he became president, Dave saw three or four sections that were used 10% of the time. So he found an area of the racetrack that was pretty much docile, and he turned it into a really fun area and a much more fun area, a popular area for people. And I think these are the kind of changes we've made. Now, the 1863 is something that Chris Kay deserves a lot of credit for. And I understand whether Chris was popular or not, Chris did a lot of good things in NYRA. And I understand what happened, and I understand exactly why he was removed. But that's not, you shouldn't deny that he was a big player. He was the guy who made 863 happen. And that's been an enormously popular and great addition to Saratoga. And what did it do? It took over for some temporary suites. Glenn Kozak wanted to build the Mile Chute. We have a Mile Chute. It's not like that crazy thing in 93, Bill, when you and I were there when we were much younger. And he built a real chute. Now, I'm not saying it's going to change the world, and maybe people can have issues with it, but it can't be a bad thing to add. What's the worst thing that happens? We don't love it, trainers don't love it, and we use it less? It's not a bad thing to give it a try, and that's something that Glenn wanted to do. Dave gave the okay to, and I think a lot of the changes you're seeing are very, very positive. And at the end of the day, remember something. Walk around Saratoga. Everybody's happy. Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's like a place. It's just you get infused with happiness. You get there and a smile comes on your face. And I think a lot of changes have been made. And I can't think of one that I think has been a negative. I think they've all been positives by adding something without taking something away. And Dave O'Rourke has played a huge role in that. And I know he's my boss, the president. He's also my friend. And you know that I love to make fun of Dave at any given opportunity I can. We've been friends a long time. But I do hope that people realize what an incredibly positive addition he has been as a president of NYRA. And he knows an enormous amount of racing. He spent a lot of time with me, probably to his detriment, but learning about racing with Glenn Kozak, with so many different people. And a lot of these changes here are really because of him and the hard work of others. And to me, the change has been positive. And the answer is the popularity of the place. People are not leaving. They're coming. More people are coming. They're coming in droves.
Absolutely. I mean, the proof is in the pudding with the handle numbers and the attendance numbers, and you know, everything just keeps getting better and better at Saratoga. Andy, thank you so much for coming on. Can't wait to see you up there. Keep up the good work, my friend.
Good. We have a dinner. We have a dinner date going on. I'm looking forward to that. And Bill, I hope I see you up here one of these days. When's the last time you've been here?
1981.
Get out of here. I beat you for a dinner in, I want to say, 1996.
Yes.
When stalwart members drowned.
I meet regularly for the New York Daily News in 2000. Back when newspapers mattered, and now they're completely irrelevant. So,
well, they're not completely irrelevant. You can read them online.
Right. Exactly. But they don't cover horse racing anymore.
So. No, they don't. But thanks so much, guys, and appreciate everything you guys do as well. So thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Great, Andy. Thank you.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Andy Serling will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV. This week's XBTV Workout of the Week is Secret Oath, a show favorite and sure a favorite of many racing fans all across the country who worked 5 furlongs in 1:01 on Friday for Dwayne Lucas. I'm sure you can see that that work on the screen right now. Dwayne said afterwards that he is very pleased with the work as the Kentucky Oaks winner points for the Grade 1 Coaching Club American Oaks this Saturday, which we're going to talk about in our weekend preview. You know, Secret Oath, I just love the campaign she ran this spring. And I thought she really deserved a break. You know, some horses, they just get 10 weeks off just because trainers and owners feel like it. You know, Secret Oath deserved that break. And I'm really excited to see what she can do in the second half of the year starting this Saturday. And if you want to see her works and you want to see all those two-year-old works up at Saratoga, do your own research. Sounds like a political thing these days. Do your own research, which means watch somebody else's YouTube video, basically. But no, for handicapping Saratoga and Del Mar, you can definitely do your own research and check out all those works and make your own judgments. Invaluable resource. I say it all the time. It's an invaluable resource, but especially this time of the year. Go to xbtv.com. All right, so this is our weekend preview segment. We're going to do one of these every single week, basically, throughout the summer and fall. There's going to be enough good racing to talk about every single week, obviously, with Saratoga opening its doors now. We got a bunch of good stuff to look forward to this weekend. It really starts off on Friday with the Grade 3 Lake George for three-year-old fillies on the Saratoga turf. But Saturday is a monster day, both at Saratoga and mainly at Monmouth. I think Monmouth, this is their day to shine. We've got multiple Grade 1 races. Obviously, the TBG.com Haskell is the biggest prize on the card. But we've also got the Grade 1 United Nations, which looks like it's going to get a pretty good field. We've got the Grade 3 Monmouth Cup, the Grade 3 Molly Pitcher, the Grade 3 Matchmaker Stakes. At Saratoga, we've got the Coaching Club American Oaks and the Caress. And also, don't want to leave out across the pond, we've got the King George, which is Saturday at Ascot, and then I've got the York Stakes as well. So definitely some action on both sides of the Atlantic. Bill, John, what are you guys looking forward to the most?
Well, obviously the Haskell, and that's because not only is it an important race on the calendar every year, but, you know, I've said this 1,000 times, and I'll keep saying it until I'm proven otherwise. I think Jack Christopher is a really special horse. And, you know, as good as he's been coming into this race, this is the most important test by far of his career for a couple of reasons. The primary ones are this. It's his first test at anything at a distance. I mean, he won last time out at 7 furlongs. Start before that, a mile. He's never run around 2 turns. And, you know, the only hole you can possibly poke at him is to say that, you know, he's unproven at a distance. Now, being unproven in a distance and can't run a distance are two very different things. I don't see any reason why he wouldn't run a mile and eighth. He's by Munnings. You know, the pedigree is fine for the distance. And I want to see him go out and put on another big show again like he did in his other races. And, you know, these, okay, so the three-year-old division is going in two directions. One to the Jim Dandy, one to the Haskell. So the Haskell is not getting a handful of really important horses that are going to the Jim Dandy, or maybe skipping the Jim Dandy, waiting for the Travers, like Charge It, the other Chad Brown horses, Early Voting, and Zanon. But you do in Taba have a horse in there that, you know, it's going to, if Taba runs his race, no reason to think he won't. You know, that's a big test for Jack Christopher. Granted, he ran 12th in the Derby. But before that, remember what he did to win the Santa Anita Derby in your second career start is a tremendous achievement for this horse. He's obviously a lot of talent in there. Nothing wrong either with Cyberknife, White of Barrio. Those are legitimate grade one winners, both of them. So the Haskell came up very strong, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what Jack Christopher can do. The same day, the coaching club at Saratoga, well, we already got our subject for the next week's show. We can talk again about the small field. It looks like there's going to be maybe only four horses in there. But, you know, if there's going to be four horses, you might as well have a race where it has some something to really sink your teeth into. That's one of the things about these Naira races. With the small fields, they still had some really good horses in there. So you have the rematch from the Kentucky Oaks of Secret Oath and Nest in there. Secret Oath wins the Kentucky Oaks. Nest is second. I kind of think, though, that the momentum is more with Nest at this point, despite that, because, you know, as much as we admire what Secret Oath has done and the campaign she's had, the fourth in the Preakness was just kind of okay. I mean, it really wasn't that. It was not one of her better races, whereas Nest is coming off a second place finish in the Belmont, where she really ran well. I got to think actually the Nest will be the favorite and in most respects, the horse to beat.
It's a great match race. And also if Society, who's a daughter of Gunrunner, and Butterbean, who's a McPeak entry, you know, also, you know, make up the rest of the field, the coaching club is going to be a really interesting race. And four horse fields never excite us. But certainly there are, you know, a couple of very legitimate horses in this race. And it's not just a match race between the top two. You know, I don't remember, guys, the last time that you had two fillies like Secret Oath and Nest that were both coming off running in a Triple Crown race, entering the American Oaks. That's very unusual in my mind. I don't remember the last time that happened. Bill, maybe because you're a better.
It's got to be unprecedented, John. Yeah, I don't think it's ever happened.
Yeah. So that's another exciting angle of the whole thing, is that they're going from not only running against the boys, but they're running in, you know, Triple Crown races where one finished second and one finished fourth, respectively, in the Belmont and the Preakness. And now they're coming, you know, I was going to say mano a mano, but filly a filly in the coaching club. Bill, you went over a number of the horses in the Haskell. It looks like it's going to be not a star-studded field, but certainly a very solid field with some of the horses you mentioned. And you know, I was never really a White of Barrio fan, but the horse doesn't miss a dance. I mean, they've run him in basically every single prep from the time he was a two-year-old in the Kentucky Jockey Club race, to the Holy Bowl, to the Florida Derby, the Kentucky Derby, and now the Ohio Derby, and now the Haskell. I mean, the horse has run in a number of races and has run well, other than the Derby, you know, was first, second, or third in every single one of those races. So White of Barrio, you know, quietly is becoming a very solid horse that dances every dance. Jack Christopher is going to be the one to be excited about, you know, see if he can handle the speed favoring racetrack to his advantage. Taba, you mentioned, coming back into the barn of Bob Baffert. And if We the People does end up running in the race, you know, again, another horse that is, you know, aspiring for greatness and is on the improve, you know, and hopefully we'll show it in the Haskell. And Joe, the only thing I'll take umbrage with you on is that you said, you know, the big races start on Saturday. How about the Rick Violette, the New York bred Rick Violette, tomorrow at Saratoga? You know, it's going to be a rematch between Our Coinage and Dakota Gold, who ran against each other in the Breeders' Cup turf, the Grade One Breeders' Cup Juvenile turf. Neither of them hit the board, but they still ran against each other. And now they're coming back and their paths are crossing again. This is like, you know, Ali and Frazier, and as Bill would say, Ali Darn affirmed. I mean, this is going to be quite a controversial kind of race if Coinage and Dakota Gold go head to head, all the way through, you know, for this very important New York bred stake race.
Yep, clear the front page, guys, at TDN. We want Coinage and Dakota Gold on the front left. But no, best of luck to John and DJ Stable in that race. Just wanted to run down some of the horses and the races you guys didn't mention. In the King George, we got Mishriff. We all remember winning the Shima Classic and the Saudi Cup last year. That was an incredible double. He was second in the Eclipse Stakes. He's going to face off against Torquator Tasso, who had that big upset win in the Arc last year, and also Westover, who was the Irish Derby winner, is going to be in that race too. So there's shortish field, but a mile and a half classic. Obviously, it's going to be a phenomenal race. In the United Nations, we got a little bit of a rematch of Gaffoe and Tribuvan. Tribuvan obviously had that monster performance in the Manhattan, best race of his life. We'll see if he can pick that up. He won the United Nations last year, so he's defending his title. Should get like 9 or 10 horses in that race. Looks like we're going to get a big field in the Molly Pitcher. In the Haskell, I'm putting out a new Better Things tomorrow, so I don't want to spoil my handicapping thoughts too much, but I'm into Cyberknife. I think Cyberknife is kind of the now horse. I think obviously Jack Christopher and Tabor are going to be tough, but I think that there's a decent chance that they hook up a little bit early and set it up for a horse that's just a little bit off the pace. So I'm interested in Cyberknife in that race. But I think, you know, all eyes are going to be on Jack Christopher. This the Bill makes the right point that this is the big test for him, just to see what he can do for the rest of the year, whether or not he's a really brilliant 7-furlong, 1-turn mile sprinter, or if he can go a mile and a quarter. You know, the question needs to be answered, and hopefully it'll be answered this Saturday. I hope that we get a little bit of a tussle early on in that race. I don't want a grab fest. I don't want a New York turf grab fest where, you know, Jack Christopher pops out to the front and everybody else just rides for a second. I want to see a real clash in that race, like we're going to see in the Coaching Club, American Oaks, as you guys mentioned, with Nest and Secret Oath. And also in the Shoevie, which is on Sunday, I think we're going to get another rematch with Clary Air and Malitha, who put on a show in the Ogden Phipps on Belmont Day. And that was the best race of their life that they each ran. So it'll be interesting to see if they can back that race up. You also have Bonnie South in there, Search Results. Probably going to be another short field, but I think we'll get some star power in there. So yeah, I mean, if wagering wise, I think Monmouth is the place to be this Saturday. I think that's going to be a really good card. I think you can have some good multi-race bets. I don't think, you know, Jack Christopher is going to be a shortish price, but he's not going to be 2-5. You know, I think that you can make money even if he wins in the multi-races in the exact or a trifecta if you get a price underneath. But yeah, then we also got some star power at Saratoga as well. Big weekend across the pond, big weekend here. Del Mar, of course, opens on Friday. We don't want to miss that. Del Mar has a handful of stakes opening weekend, and you know, we salute Del Mar. They do a lot of great things in terms of safety. They also have big fields, and obviously it's going to be packed house on Friday at Del Mar. Still haven't been. That's one of the tracks now that I need to get to. Now that I've crossed Keeneland off my list, got to get to Del Mar one summer. So TDN, hopefully we can figure out a way to get us there for a live show or something like that. Just an excuse for me to get to Del Mar. Hint, hint, Sue Finley. All right, so yeah, that's a ton to look forward to this week. We'll be back next week to wrap it all up. The TDN Writers' Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses, stakes action, for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. You can learn more at westpointtb.com. If you're interested in having the chance to win an ownership experience in a 2-year-old colt named Riverside, trained by John Sadler, enter West Point's annual Del Mar Challenge. Contestants pick one jockey, one trainer, one horse from each grouping of names to earn points throughout the Del Mar meet. You can learn more at westpointtb.com/Del Mar Challenge. West Point has a busy weekend coming up at Ellis Park and Saratoga, starting off with Shadow Matter, who runs later today in race 6 at Saratoga. Best of luck to the West Point partners this weekend, the rest of the Saratoga meet. As I've said before, still looking forward to seeing all those high-priced yearlings turn into 2-year-olds and really get to show their stuff this summer at Saratoga, and then probably later in the fall as well. Loaded for bear this year with the babies. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up and down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own Legacy graduate. Brewhouse sold for $30,000 at the 2019 Keeneland November sale. Undefeated in her first two starts, breaking her maiden on debut and winning the Francis Genter Stakes this past Saturday at Canterbury. I was actually watching that card because there was a Canterbury Pick 5 carryover. And, you know, can't miss that with a 10% takeout. And I saw Brewhouse look very good, now 2-for-2, and obviously has a bright future ahead of her. Also, a reminder that the entry deadline for the Keeneland November sale is August 1st. Give Tommy or Wendy a call. They will hook you up, and they will take care of you for the rest of the sales this year. Keeneland September, Keeneland November, they got your back. This week's Remy cartoon, very fitting. We talked about last week on the show the advent of the penny breakage era in Kentucky, which we're hoping that comes to other jurisdictions, especially here in New York. It's a son talking to his dad, who's of course reading today's entries in the Forb, and the son says, "Dad, my allowance is $5. You pay me $4.80. What gives?" And dad says, "Breakage." That's it. I mean, that's a pretty good analogy. Only bone I would pick is that betting on the horses is harder than anything that kid did for his allowance. That's for damn sure. But we're definitely getting screwed on that, Ed. So shout out to Rebby, always having the horse players in mind when he does the cartoons. That's my guy. Rap time. My name is Joe, and I'm here to say John sucks at beats in a major way. It's getting a little silly towards the end of the show. Okay, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Don't forget, the Keeneland November deadline is August 1st. You can learn more at november.keeneland.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Andy Serling, producer Patty Wolf, our associate producer Katie Petruniak, and our editors Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. We'll see you next week.